Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and you know, we've talked about original D&D versus basic D&D before. We love them both. We're celebrating the 1974 birth of D&D, and we both started with basic D&D around 1980. But, you know, we haven't talked about the actual combat mechanics yet, so let's get ready to roll initiative! All that and more...
Hi everyone. Sorry if I cut Dan off there with the credits a little bit. He threw me with our lovely intro. Well done, Dan. Viewers, if you're new to this show or you didn't realize, or if you thought things were radically changed for this after six seasons of doing this, they haven't. At the end of the show, we will be hosting our after party chat. What is that? That is a private video chat hosted by Dan and I at the end of every show with our patrons. It's we take a little break in between, so about 10 after 2 Eastern time, we will begin our after party chat. We'd love for you to join us. You can do so by becoming a patron. Join. Go to Wandering DMs. Nope. Go to patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier. You'll get an invite to our Discord server. Join up before the end of the show and then pop on after the show is over and join in the chat.
Viewers, don't miss your surprise roll. Become a patron and join the after chat about an hour. We'd love to see you there. We adore it.
Oh, dear. Obviously a little flustered. Okay, let's go. Let's get into it, Dan. Let's talk about combat.
That's
combat.
Great. That's great. DX. It's fresh. So this is the third ODB. Time we've talked about it. And, you know, originally this was going to be a one hour little chat about the differences between original D&D and basic, because this is how we started. And when we run our games, Paul, we run them pretty similar. And the little bit of differences are generally because of which of those two editions we're thinking about at a particular moment. So this is the third.
I'm super curious now to see. I'm very curious to see which direction this goes, because I have a theory, which is that when we get into the text and talk about how combat is supposed to be run in OD&D versus BX, what we'll discover is that I theorize that the way I run it is neither of those.
Yeah. and me too. And I think me too as well. Yeah. Also. Yeah. And that here's some stuff we're not going to talk about. So previously we talked about like equipment and weapons and armor and some of the little nuances there. We talked about fighters possibly getting extra attacks at higher levels and how that changes encounter numbers. So we talked about that before. We don't need to rehash that. Go back to episode 2 for that kind of stuff. I do feel that one of the biggest differences between those editions is whether fighters get sweep attacks against, you know, one hit die enemies. So that makes a big difference. But we already chatted about that.
You already talked about
so, that. So, yeah. So if you dig into Moldvay's BX that came out in 1981 that we both have run for a long time, and Paul, I notice you have multiple boxed copies on the bookshelf behind you. You have not one but two of those pink boxes from 81.
I do. One of those boxes is not in great condition, so I bought a second one because I am addicted like that. One of them has original dice in it, though. One of them is like absolutely complete.
Oh wow!
Original dice, all the advertising, all that nonsense. It's a great piece of nostalgia for me. It's the very edition of the game that I began with very, very, very long time ago.
Yep.
So,
and also,
so
I also
you want to start with
type of basic D&D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I started with a there. Type of basic D&D. Yep.
There you go. Right. You started with this guy, I think.
I did. Right. Which I have. Yeah, so the Holmes Basic came out a couple of years ago and really set the groundwork for that. But it's a type of basic D&D, and the the Mold Bay Red Box was actually my longest running campaign. I did actually run that for a long time in the 80s.
Well, let's get into it. I'm fascinated that you wanted to start with BX rather than OD&D. It feels a little backwards from the way we usually tackle it, but let's go. I'm even going to jump the gun here and see that show that you happen to have page B24, which I'm staring at in front of my face. You've got it here, so I'm going to put it up on screen. Here it is, the combat sequence. You know, only three sub-levels of bullets. Very simple.
good point. Yes, I see that. Not that much nesting. You're right. And you know what? Easy to find, right? It was easy for you to find this on the page. It's labeled combat sequence. It's clearly a table in the book that you that is findable. So kudos to Tom Moldvay for that.
Yeah. All right. So let's break it down. So it basically is four major top level things. Each side rolls initiative. The side that wins acts first. If simultaneous, everything happens at the same time. And then it gets into like all the different sub elements of what a side does. The side with the next highest initiative acts second, and so on, using the order above. The DM handles any surrenders, retreats, etc., as they occur. Cool. That all seems reasonable. So it's group initiative. There you go. That's to start. We're doing group initiative.
Yep.
Yep. On a straight D6.
Rolled every round.
No stat modifiers here. And then, so really the interesting section is the B section, which breaks it down to what each side, right? This is what each side is going to do during its turn. They're going to make all morale checks. They're going to do all movement. They're going to do all missile fire, all magic spells, and then all melee or hand-to-hand actions. Which is a little strange when you remind yourself that this is per side, right? So if we're talking about the players, you're going to have all the players roll morale for all their henchmen. Then you have all the players do all their movement. Then you're going to have all the players do all their missile fire. Like, this is strange, Dan. This feels like I've got to do multiple loops around the table with all my players over and over again. Any missile fire? Any missile fire? Okay. Any magic? Any magic? Any magic? Okay. Any melee? Right? That's a bunch of work. Is that how you're reading it?
You know, I didn't even think about that. I should have anticipated that. For some reason, I didn't, because I was focused on another difference. Do we agree that the players 1, 2, 3, 4, they all move, then they all take their missile fire, then they do their magic spell. Do we all agree with that? Honestly, I guess that isn't how I run it myself. I don't think this is how I ran it at the time.
Are you saying that there should be a sub element here which says in between B and the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there should be some? Yeah. I'm still reading this like code. This is this is what they get for indenting levels. I'm reading this like code, right? So the side that wins, then you want a for each loop of for each player. Okay, individual player. Any morale, any movement, any missile, any magic, any melee. Okay, player two. Any morale, any movement, any missile, any magic, any melee.
It seems to say the former thing, right? It seems to say, And I think based on what came before in wargaming, I think that the tradition would be that, you do all your movement for a side, then you do all your missile fire, and if we do read that way, I do agree that it seems burdensome to me to go around the table multiple times, and I think when I've tried to do stuff like that. You know, players, it doesn't feel like other games. It doesn't feel like other board games. So I think if you try to do this, certainly a player would go, you know, I run up and hit him with my sword and you have to go, wait, no, you're just running. We're going to come back around to the sword play later. And that's going to be a little weird.
Yeah. I have a couple of different problems with this as written. So first of all, because we're doing sided initiative, right. If I'm going to go through and say, you know, all movement, do I still need to resolve ties here? Right. If all the players are all moving at the same time, in theory, probably most of them can just move. But like sometimes it is important which player moved first. And now I got to adjudicate that. Right.
Yeah, correct. Correct. I agree with that.
Yeah.
Now let me put up a comment here. Mm-hmm. Right. So I know that our friend Joshua, if I recall correctly, is a fairly big fan of this kind of phased combat that we're talking about. So he I believe he's run it like this and mm-hmm. finds ways to make it work. And so Joshua's comment here is that what he does is he open outcries, who's going to move? Okay, you kind of outcry and we'll handle that as the DM. Then who's firing missiles? Anybody? Probably not many people, frankly. Who's casting magic? Anybody? And you kind of get those as a group. I guess I would have to try that myself to test it out. I that probably works for like a smaller number of players, like four or five. I could see that.
Yeah, I still feel like the adjudication of ties is troublesome, not only because of what I just said about like having to deal with, you know, sometimes, yeah, for the most part, who's going to move? Everybody move. And it doesn't matter if player A, B, C, or D goes first, but sometimes it does. And the sometimes gets me because of the other edge case here, which very specifically the top tells me that if we roll the same number on initiative, all actions performed by each side of the that everybody acts at the same time, right? The side that wins initiative. Right. I've lost it. Where was that text? I saw it here somewhere, right?
It's in B. It's in the parentheses in part B.
Yeah. If simultaneous, all actions are performed by each side at the same time. Now it's okay. Now I got to move all the bad guys and all the players at the same time, and I got to resolve cases. There's going to be, I think, more of that edge case of, well, who goes first when it matters. At this point, do I even have an initiative system anymore? And with rolling a D6, that simultaneous action, not that uncommon, right? 1 in 6, it's going to happen.
Yes, agreed, totally. Yeah. So it's wonder like how many of us have actually played BX and done this. I'm pretty sure that I always I don't recall a time where I haven't said to a particular player, "Tell me what you do this round." I move, I take out the sword, I hit somebody, I cast a spell, whatever you're doing. So I'm sure that I've never run, as many years as I did run a BX campaign, I'm pretty sure I never ran it like that.
I suspect I maybe tried it. I think there was a point where I was trying to like, no, I'm really going to dig into the rules as written, and I'm going to try and do it exactly as the text tells me. And I maybe did it once and went, nope, don't like it. Not for me.
Yeah. I'll say a thing that I did try to do with my OED rules is I did try to take little pieces of this, and I did try to have, I think, missiles and I did try to have missiles and magic go off before other things. And so, and I might have a large table, frankly. I remember doing it with like about 10 people, and I started to go around the table and say, you know, do you have missiles magic? And they'd go, well, no, but I run up with my axe. And I'd have to say, nope, that's not happening now. And it felt like a very negative vibe, frankly, of like, nope.
Yeah. Well, without much happening. I mean, players are used to other kinds of games, right? Other board games or whatnot are more used to, we go around the table and when it's your turn, you do all your things, right? You do all your things, whatever they are. And then you can stop thinking about stuff as we move on to the next person. So I feel like anybody who's used to any kind of, you know, other traditional board games is going to get caught up here. I did like, though, that you pointted out that like maybe it does feel a bit more like a war game, which makes sense, right? It's kind of showing its wargaming roots here when each side was a whole army and that army was controlled by one person, typically.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. I think that's a really good observation. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that phasing, you know, was tricky.
Sorry? What was tricky?
The phasing was sticky is that there was this separation all the way, I think, up until third edition D&D circa 2000, is they kept something like this in advanced D&D first edition and I think second edition. And all the way up until 2000, they still kept some kind of language like this from the war game.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see it. I can see that it might feel more natural to folks who are used to war games. I want to point out another interesting thing on this table before we move on from this chart, right? Another interesting thing is that it does specifically call out under both melee and missile fire that the DM rolls all damage. Which I find very interesting.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And remember, at one point, you know, DM rolled everything, rolled all the dice. In original D&D, it says the DM rolls every character's ability scores, every player character's ability scores. So here's an element that makes that explicit. And I would overlook that, Paul, if you hadn't pointed that out. I have a visiting cat with me, and the cat wants to get involved so much, right? I'm gonna let the cat in the studio here. I hope everybody's okay with that.
Didn't know you were gonna get a special guest this time, viewers. But sure enough, special guest, fans, friends, cat. Very eager to voice its opinion on. Okay.
We're big tent here.
Okay. So, how does this differ from OD&D, yeah. Dan?
Okay. So, you turn to OD&D and you want to find where the combat sequence is, and you go, "Wait a minute, where is it? Where is it? Original D&D, 1974. Is it in the player's booklet? Is it in the DM's booklet?" And you flip around for a while, and you go, "I don't think there is one." There isn't a combat sequence here. And then you go, yes, I'm also supposed to have the chainmail rules. That's part of the required equipment. And then you finally turn back to the chainmail rules and like the second page there. I think I have that with a red dot, Paul. And then you go, there's one. There's a couple. You can pick. Do you want the chainmail 1972 move counter move system at the top of the page, or would I prefer the simultaneous movement option at the bottom of the page? And to make a long story short, the main difference is that the option at the bottom, everybody pre-writes orders. And it's a really good point you make, Paul, that presumably there's only two players. There's two opposing players. There's no DM, there's no referee. So we're trying to find how to make it fair for both players making commitments to their moves without one player getting too much of an advantage. So the option at the bottom is both sides write down their orders, and then you simultaneously work out each move and see if they run into each other halfway together or something like that, which is something, I mean, I've never liked that. That's honestly baked into a number of things in original D&D. I've never liked that. Even Peter Perla in The Art of Wargaming says that pre-writing orders is a real drag. And really no game's gotten super popular with pre-written orders like that.
So I feel like, again, it's emulating something that makes more sense in a large-scale combat, right? Like, if you think about, like, what is the real-world action that this is simulating, right? It makes sense when you're like, well, I'm a general of this vast army. Yes, I'm going to have to give orders to a person or write them down or something. They're going to have to be delivered, you know, through or coded through the beat of the drum or the trill of the fife, what have you, to inform which unit does what. So that, like, separation of I issue an order, it goes somewhere, that person executes it, makes a bit more sense. And it becomes really weird when you're saying, well, I just control one character. I'm just me. Like, I have to tell myself what to do. I have to write myself a note. Hey, don't remember. Don't forget to, right? Am I like sticking little post-its on the inside of my shield? Don't forget to swing your sword. Thanks.
I think it can also make some sense when the scale of the movement is much larger than the scale of the attacks. So if you're going to be sailing for 30, like a couple minutes while your cannons are reloading and you have to go downwind and then cut and raise a sail and cut another way while the opponent's doing the same thing, I can see why you'd want to map that out as one single thing that you'll resolve. But if it's smaller scale and I take a couple steps and stab you with a dagger, that's really one motion and shouldn't have to be separated out like that. So I agree with that. Now, either of these options you go with, whether you write down the orders or not, the sequence is more or less, it's fate. Now here it's phased for both players. So it's not just one side goes through a bunch of phases, but in every single phase, both player A and player B have to both do their stuff. So what happens here is basically both players move half, and then there's an option for missile fire, and then both players move their other half, and there's more missile fire, and then finally melees at the end of the turn. So here, I think the main difference, so you kind of, it's kind of has the flavor of Moldvay. I think Mold, which I think is how I can infer some of what Moldvay meant in BX. So kind of the same sort of sequencing. The main difference is both player A and B move half, and then both player A and B can shoot, and then both player A and B can move again and shoot again and melee again. So here again, which is feasible with maybe two players, but when you try to expand this to 4 or 5 or 8 or 10 or 20 players, I do feel that that kind of phase sequencing becomes a lot more problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that. We were talking about we kind of blurred over this a little bit, but you were talking about the simultaneous action. And I feel like that's the one part of some of these rules that I've always thought that could be cool. That could, in my brain, as I read it, I think, that could be fun. It could be this interesting moment of this turn is special. Yes. This turn is different, right? We're gonna have to fly by the seat of our pants a little bit more because we're all just on top of each other. But the fact is, it just causes so much confusion at the tabletop, and it interrupts play so much. I think it's just not worth it.
I that's my experience as well. And some people can differ. And for me, the thing that always sticks for me is if one person has a spear and another person comes in combat distance, I do want the spear to stab them as they come into range. But that implies some kind of interruption where the player with the spear has to know about that rule and has to call it out. And that always, for me, I've just seen that fail over and over again with new players, to remind them, you've got to tell me that you've got a spear when I come at you. And that just, for me, that's failed again and again and again, over and over and over. And I just had to scrap it. And that's just a little bit of a taste that I've run into when I've tried to do that. That seems attractive, and it just, for me, it just hasn't worked.
So, I mean, so clearly all got fixed by first edition AD&D, I'm assuming, right? I mean, it's clearly, we don't like what's in OD&D. We don't like what's in BX. It must be fixed in AD&D, right?
Now, remember that AD&D came out before BX. Right. So the sequencing that we mostly original D&D, AD&D in 1977, 79, and then BX came out in 1981. So the BX rules were actually looking at AD&D and trying to modify that a little bit. So great, great instinct, Paul. But these wargaming phases, like I say, were sticky through AD&D, through BX for quite a while. And I'll say the interesting thing, so remember in Chainmail, they want, right, part of what they want is they want missiles to be flying through the air while a move is happening, which, you know, is a reasonable thing to want. And how they do it there is you move half, then you can shoot, then you can move your other half. So, you know, Gary with AD&D still wanted that. And the interesting thing, and I actually did, I thought this question would come up, Paul. So there's a table I have that does not have a colored dot on it. Can you pull that up?
Sure. Let me just find that real quick. Here we go.
And I wouldn't have remembered this if I hadn't looked at this morning. So here's the AD&D sequence, and the equivalent to what we're looking at is the ABCD in part four there. And so the sequence there is basically item one. So item A, you can flee, is the very first thing. Item B and C are some kind of, you can try to communicate. And then item D is you shoot missiles and magic. And then item E is the movement. And then item FGH basically is the melee. So the sequencing is different here. Is in AD&D, you shoot first, then you move, then you melee. And that's different from what we see, what Moldvay was cleaning that up to. You can move first, then you can shoot, then you can melee, which is an interesting little twist. And so again, that's, I've tried to do this, like you can shoot first, then you can move, to get this same kind of sensibility. And it just, for me, it just really hasn't worked.
That's interesting. Why not? What do you feel like you're fighting against when you try to implement these things? Like what's getting in the way?
there's a moment where I ask my player, I go around the table, I ask my players, can you shoot missiles? And most of the answer is no. So we mm-hmm. wind up most of the combat sequences, a whole bunch of nope, 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 nope. I'm shooting. Nope, 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 nope. And that just, it seems like, why are we doing this now?
Yeah. 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 And that's all, I think, ultimately what both of us are after, right? Is to just something a little more streamlined. Right? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And, now, you know, something that the player can, you know, kind of imagine and describe, you know, something vibrant, right? I move, I jump, I swing, I, you know, I hit, as opposed to little tiny granular, like, well, I'm moving and then waiting around the table for, I draw my sword and then waiting around the table for whatever the next thing is.
So I think William has the answer for us here. The solution, obviously, is we need weapon speeds and segments. That's what we need.
No? Great. So droll. So droll, gentlemen. Yeah.
So here's my question, Dan, I guess then, like, what do you use actually in your game today? And where does it come from? What edition of the game is it? Does it emerge from?
That's great. I go around the table in order. There's one roll for initiative up front to see whether players versus monsters go first. And then I just keep cycling around the table in order so people can visualize when it's coming up their turn. And I ask a particular player for everything they're doing. You tell me what you're doing and we will resolve it right now. So there's movement and there's magic and there's attacks. And the one thing, the one and only thing that I do that occasionally trips up newer players is trying to maintain a little bit of the flavor of the intent of original D&D and chainmail is I do say, you gotta move first, then you can do your attacks. Yep. And occasionally, like people that are third or fifth edition, I guess fifth edition players, they want to be able to swap that up. And for a couple reasons, I mandate you got to do all your movement first, then you can attack. And part of the reason is you can't stab somebody and then run away and not get hit, right? That's off the table. That's what I use to replace the whole back attack things, which I don't think make a sense when you escape from combat. And also, it just makes sense to me that if I'm running with an axe, right, the momentum, the impetus is like, yeah, that helps me, right? If I'm running at somebody to hit, that helps me. Whereas if I try to tap you with my weapon while I'm going backwards, that seems disadvantageous. So that's almost the only, I do have that in order to shoot or cast, you have to stand still. Sometimes people are surprised by that. But that's pretty explicit in different places in original D&D. So those are the two restrictions that people coming from maybe fifth edition get surprised about.
Yeah,
for me.
I don't know. I mean, I do pretty much the same thing. It sounds like, and you do this too, right? I still use group initiative. We still use group initiative. And then I will. If we come up with the same number on the die, I'll just re-roll it. I don't want to deal with simultaneous or anything like that. Or I might, if I'm feeling generous, I might just say ties go to the players or something to keep it moving quickly. And then I go around the table. I do like going around the table. We can talk about that a bit, about why that's pleasant. But it's kind of, right, it's the Monopoly version, right?
Right?
Rules, right? And that's really, I think, what I'm leaning into is just what feels most familiar and natural to the player so it doesn't get in the way, right? I don't want it to get in the way. So we're going to go around the table. You move, you roll the die, you move your token around the board, then you do your action of buying property or whatnot, right? It's standard board game procedure.
I'm a fairly big proponent of that. I'm really looking for ways to be welcoming to brand new players. Clearly, the players I get don't have wargaming experience. And I think about the exact terms, Paul, to make that, you know, a reasonable entry point.
Yeah. I think unfortunately, the thing is that what we're fighting against, right, is just years of other kinds of game playing, right? And it makes sense to me that the original rules, like the more we talk about it, the more it makes sense to me that the original rules were built for people who were used to wargaming. So all of this stuff made sense to them. And to you and me, we're scratching our heads over it because we're like, I don't really play a lot of war games, honestly. I got shelves upon shelves of standard board games, but I don't really play war games.
And I think, you know, I think your point about these techniques make a lot of sense for when there's just two players. And, you know, D&D came out of kind of accidentally expanding. The game was so much fun and so popular that, oh my God, we've got 20 people at my table all of a sudden. And, you know, some of those rules were stretched to their breaking point. You know, I also think like the when I'm fleeing, you get a free attack was an accident that made sense in the war game of like a unit withdrew and then was confused and was actually paused there for a while. So I think there's a lot of rules like that.
I think we should talk a little bit about retreating here and how retreating is impacted by these various versions of the rules, because I feel like that's important.
Yeah,
I do feel like modern versions of D&D have made retreat almost impossible, which makes me sad. I feel like older editions of the game, retreat is a more viable strategy. And I want whatever rules we end up using here for turn sequence, I want it to enable that. If a player has decided, I'm done, I don't want to fight anymore, I run away, I don't want to just immediately crush them for that choice. And I do feel like a lot of the more modern versions of D&D do exactly that. They're like, oh, ho, ho, you poor sap, you're leaving combat, everybody dogpile them on them.
Now, I agree with the intent, right? I could not agree with the intent more, Paul, that, you know, fleeing should be an option. And it's both, I personally think, both realistic and makes for good gameplay. Now, I would differ, Paul, in that my reading is that that's been a problem in D&D in all editions. Like, every edition since Chainmail has had this punishment when you try to withdraw, when you try to get out of combat. And that it's been, again, that's been surprisingly sticky, because to me that looks like clearly a bad rule, but that has that punishment has been part of the rule since the inception. We see it, you know, in Chainmail. We see it in the BX rules, like, which is pretty weirdly consistent, actually. So like if you go to page B25, right?
Yeah, you're going to talk about the retreat rules here in BX, which is which frankly have always confused me completely, right? So let's just I don't think we have a thing to put on screen here, so I'll just read it.
I don't.
Any movement backwards at more than half the normal movement rate is a retreat. If a creature tries to retreat, the opponent may add +2 to all to hit rolls, and the defender is not allowed to make a return attack. In addition to the bonus on to hit rolls, the attacks are further adjusted by using the defender's armor class without a shield. This is someone without a shield. Any attacks from behind are adjusted in the same manner. This confuses the crap out of me, because it talks, like, I get the idea of like, okay, you're full out retreating from combat, so I'm going to give a bonus for people to hit you. Like, yeah, okay, I guess maybe you're just focused on running away. You're not really focused on your weapons aren't at the ready. So maybe you're a little easier to hit. But it kind of implies that maybe the attacker gets a free... And the whole thing about, like, and you don't get to attack back? Like, when are these attacks happening? Right. I'm confused. Because if I moved, if I followed the sequence and I did my movement before all the other things, I'm now no longer in melee combat with you, right? Like, I've done it. When are you going to make this attack at +2? When does that happen?
That's a good point. So that's a place where they are copying a rule from original D&D and Holmes and AD&D, where it's very clear you get a free attack. You get an immediate free attack when someone does that. And they've kind of lost, the editing just slightly lost the fact that you get this free attack. So that's a really good point, that's clearly vague and weird in these rules.
Yeah. So I have interpreted that in the past as, sure, if you are full out just booking it, I don't want to be in this fight anymore, I'm running away, yes, other people get a +2 to hit you, but I don't give them any kind of free attack. So maybe if they're like kind of stand and fire at you with a bow, maybe. Okay, great. Plus two for that because they're running away. If you're happen to be running past another enemy, right? So sure, maybe they'll get that plus two attack. But I don't just de facto give them a free attack. And I think that's important because I feel like once you go down that road, once we start talking about attacks of opportunity or whatever, or free back attacks, it just running away just stops being an option entirely.
I agree. That's a big problem. I will point out, like, I'm just looking at advanced right here, and it's a little bit more explicit and also worse because it says any at such time as any creature decides it can break off the engagement, flee the melee. To do so, however, allows the opponent a free attack or attack routine. So not only do you get a free attack at that moment, but if you are a dragon with a claw bite routine, they get the whole sequence. They get the whole cycle of all their attacks. Add a bonus from the back with a modifier, with no shield, with no dexterity bonus. And I have always thought that was a problem, just like you. That's a big problem. And in my OED house rules, that gets wiped off the table.
Yeah. And I think you get
you can
that
run. Go ahead and run.
Free. You get this fix for free by doing, I think, what Dan said earlier of saying all movement has to come before attacks, right? Got to do all your movement before your attacks. That way, if you're retreating, if you're running away, you're not going to get to attack because you ran away and you're no longer next to the opponent anymore. Yep.
And look, if the opponent wants to, on their turn, if they have the capacity to chase after you and catch them on their movement and get an attack, yes, they can do that. And yes, that'll be at a plus two modifier or whatever from the back. They can do that. But they've got to pull themselves out of line. They've got to potentially expose themselves, you know, past the enemy lines or whatever. And they got to think about, do I really want to chase you to make that happen? It's not for free as an interrupty type thing at the moment where you turn around. I also think that's a problem. So I will say, look, again, to praise Moldvay, at least right above that paragraph, he has a withdrawal rule. Right, the clause that Paul was saying, well, this is what happens if you move more than half. But Moldvay has an option to withdraw safely. You can back up, you can move half, you're still defending yourself, and at least that avoids the apparently free attack there. Advanced D&D does not have that as an option. Original D&D doesn't explicate that anywhere. So at least Moldvay is getting in there and trying to grapple with that weirdness. And I gotta salute him for that.
Now, so by your read of that, so it's called the fighting withdrawal, right? Fighting withdrawal. Mm-hmm. You can move up to half your normal movement rate per level, per round. You still get an attack, Dan? It says fighting. Am I making attacks as well as moving backwards?
I don't know. if we pay attention to the order of operations, I think we would say no, because you got to do that movement before the melee happens. So my take would be probably not. Could be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for me, really,
there's an example down below where that doesn't happen. So there's an example, a paragraph later, where Huxley, the fighter, withdraws from a gargoyle, and the gargoyle is attacking him, but Huxley doesn't get an attack back, so apparently not.
Yeah. For me, the only real difference between fighting withdrawal and, like, absolute running away is whether or not your opponents are going to get this plus two or not, right? That's really the only difference. Yeah. And I kind of don't mind that rule, right? Again, if I am just absolute out running away, I move my full movement rate away from the enemy because I just don't want to fight them anymore. And then on that enemy's turn, they choose to chase me down and they have as good or faster a move rate than I do. I am very happy to give that person that plus two, right? They're chasing me down. They're coming after me and they just make the attack. Sure. Give them a plus two. And I don't mind then saying, like, and the fighting withdrawal difference is if you only move half your rate, yeah, they don't get that plus two, but the whole basically you're just moving the combat across the play surface.
Yeah. Maybe to a place that's more advantageous to one character rather than another, right? Maybe you're drawing somebody into a trap. That's all legitimate. It's a risk reward that they got to consider.
Yep.
totally agree. Totally agree. You know, one other thing about the encounters in Moldvay is like what's the a difference between BX and the original line, of course, is that what's the scale, right? What's the scale of the action? And in original D&D, and boy, Gary really leaned into this, and advanced players will maintain this. He says the one round of combat is a whole minute. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. It's very abstract. It's like a pig pen dust up. There's multiple sword fights and axes and claws and karate chops and all kinds of things happening for a full minute. And in the basic line, very different. Starting with Holmes, right? Even before Moldvay, it says that one round is 10 seconds, which seems like, you know, about enough time to maybe get, you know, one or two arrows off in reality. Or, you know, one legitimate blow with a heavy weapon. And I think that, and of course, now if we look at modern D&D, 3rd edition, 5th edition, they hold on to that much shorter, you know, one round is one single blow. And you know what? Chainmail said that, right? Chainmail actually didn't put down a scale for their man-to-man action, but they were using the word, like, you get a blow. You get one strike with your weapon. Seemed to be the intent. Right. And to me, it seems like on a visceral level, like you're striking once. It's very concrete. It's very cinematic. Makes sense to me. And that's ultimately what's historically won out, is the shorter round scale. So Moldvay was on board with that early on.
So is it just AD&D that has this long, this longer, like 1 minute
original
round?
Original D&D says 1 minute.
Original D&D.
AD&D continues that. Yep, all the way through second edition. So again, it wasn't until third edition in 2000 that they finally got away from the 1 minute round. You know, the advanced players were very, very intransigent about, the round's 1 minute. It really never made sense to me, and they finally got rid of it in 2000.
Of course, in BX, I think we have the confusion, right, of how long is a round versus how long is a turn, right? Then we have 10-minute turns in BX, and that feeds into your spell durations, which makes all your spells weirdly incredibly long duration.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And same with, you know, all those early editions. So Advanced does the same. Basic does the same. Again, in Chainmail, it was only 1 minute. So it seemed to be, again, a little bit more sensible, and then they kind of maybe accidentally changed that, got stuck on it. And the other interesting thing that I want to bring up about the encounters in Moldvay is what's the distance scale. And this is very interesting, because we all know that starting with original D&D, they didn't have any scale in Chainmail for the man-to-man combat. So they started playing original D&D, and they said, well, one of our table inches is 10 feet in the dungeon. 1 inch is 10 feet. That's a nice round number. I don't think they really thought about it very much. It doesn't match how big your miniatures are. So there's a really interesting thing in Holmes. He says the same thing, 1 inch is 10 feet. So here's two separate places in the same book in BX. And I've always thought this to be pretty fascinating, because it contradicts itself. On page B19, which is the core combat chapter, it says, if miniature figures are used, the actual movement can be represented as scaled. 1 inch equals 10 feet on your play space. And then on the last page of the book, which has this like dungeon mastering as a fine art, which to me feels kind of like Tom Moldvay's personal house rules, almost the very last thing in the book, it says, if you use miniatures, you could use plexiglass. The sheet should have 1 inch squares, and a scale of 1 inch equals 5 feet should be used when moving the figures. So in two different places in the same book, he's saying you should use 5 feet or 10 feet per inch. To my knowledge, this is the first place that ever suggested using 1 inch is 5 feet. It matches the miniatures scale. And ultimately, that's what won out, right? Ultimately, that's what we see in 3rd edition, 4th edition, 5th edition today. It fundamentally makes more sense. And Moldvay was what kind of had a little mini revolution here on this point, and ultimately he was right about that.
Interesting. I feel like the problem it always causes, right, is that is the difference between a single square, right? Again, we get used to using these gridded play mats, right? That we're moving our miniatures around that have a square who's as big as the footprint of our miniature. You know, usually about 1 inch per square, and so 1 inch per 5 feet makes lots of sense. But we're using these maps from the scenarios, which are definitely using a 10 foot square to draw the overall size of the dungeon.
You're right. You're right. That is a little bit of a conversion problem. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
that is
kind of too bad that we got into the habit of drawing our maps like that. Although it's I don't know. It is easier for that level of play because typically when I'm doing larger scale dungeon exploration, I'm not drawing every single hallway and every single room on a board. And so being able to quickly count, you know, decimal squares for feet is nice.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. I think some of my colleagues in the math department would be what's a conversion factor of times two? Anybody can do that. No problem. But when you're juggling lots of other stuff and you're thinking about, does this fit on my battle map and stuff like that? Anybody can in fact trip up over that. I've done it, and I will admit that it's a little bit of an awkward point that you do have. You can't immediately visualize exactly what it's going to be on your battle map. You do have to do this conversion all the time.
Yeah. So you're generally using one inch equals 5 feet, but you're still using the kind of 30, 60, 90, 120 movement rates. Right?
The movement rates. Yes. Yes. Ish. So for me, in original and AD&D, of course, all the distances were actually expressed in inches. So your movement is either 3 or 6 or 9 or 12 inches. So for me, I just use that. You completely unarmored and you can move totally free. That's 12 inches, which turns out to be 60 feet.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is if you have a movement rate of 60 feet, are you moving 6 inches or 12 inches on the board?
Your movement rate is 12 and you can move 12 inches.
There you go. Okay. So just assume everything's in inches and the scaling. Gotcha. Yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad. Because certainly like max move again, 120 feet, because I'm totally unencumbered. Having to measure, 24 inches of movement on a board is kind of a pain in the butt. 12 inches does feel better.
Yes. And to be clear to the viewers, right, the reason why you're even asking about this, Paul, is that the basic rules were the first place to switch from distances in inches to actual feet. So anytime you're looking around, you even see it on the first paragraph here, they're expressing movement as 60 feet, whereas in original D&D, your movement would be 6 inches or something like that. So I'm personally accustomed to seeing all the spells, the attacks, the missile ranges all in inches, like in original or advanced. And the basic set was, again, the first place to switch it all to actual feet. And, of course, that's what you see in D&D today.
However, I will point out, I do feel like that is, especially when I've gamed with you at the helm, Dan, and we have some new players, I feel like that is the most common trip up point for folks, is they see something written in inches and assume it's literal inches and go, really? This spell only reaches 12 inches? It's a foot range on this spell? That's terrible.
Usually in the, just as we start, there's usually quite like how long is a turn and what is an inch? And yeah, that does usually have to be addressed at the start of a session. You're not wrong. Mm-hmm. Having done that, we don't have to do conversions, right? We don't have to do every round. We don't have to do a mental division about like my movement's this, so how many inches is it? Feel that we answer the question once and then we don't have to keep doing math after the fact.
Yep. That's fair. Dan, is there anything else about the combat sequence that we need to dig into here? I know we were debating about possibly digging into the turn sequence, but I feel like we're possibly running out of time, and we shouldn't do that today.
I might possibly agree with that. The turn, the ultimately, you know, the moment where the action is really life or death is in the combat sequence. So, you know, and I know that some people would say combat shouldn't be the most interesting thing, but it is the most deadly thing. So your players are probably pretty focused on that. And I think as DMs, we want to give them a good, understandable experience about what the risks and rewards are. So I think we're certainly very focused on that.
Let me ask this one question, because we didn't really dig into this. We both talked about wanting to go around the table. What's your process for that? Are you consistent about which direction you go? Is there any point in any of combat where you break that?
You know, for me, the main thing, and I know that sometimes, Paul, you just reverse the order of the table for variety. For me, the main time is if somebody clearly has initiated the action. So if one person is barging through a door in advance of other people, right? Or they've start, like I get the, you know, someone announces that they're attacking before anybody else is. I do give them a spotlight. I do give them the first action and then go back around my normal order. And then I usually have to say, remind me that you already went. Because as I come around, I'm going to forget about it, frankly.
Yeah.
But if somebody clearly is taking the lead or has been ambushed or something like that, I give them the first action. Other than that, Paul, I try to be pretty darn consistent for predictability purposes.
I like that too. And I'll say that there's one case that has caused me some trouble over the years, which is when the players are forcibly in a configuration that is a line that is different from the order they're in around the table. So I'm thinking like we're in a very narrow tunnel, or we're on a narrow rope bridge, and the order of players, right, is 2, 5, 7, 1, 3, right? Like something really unusual. I find like going around the table just causes all kinds of chaos as people are like, oh, well, now he's in my way. Now this person's in my way. Oh, no, I have to wait. Yeah. And right. And it just gets really messy and gross. Versus trying to remember, oh, I have to go in this weird order that I've maybe written down on the side of, this is the order you are on the bridge. And so we're just going to go by that order instead of the table order. Kind of annoys me, frankly. I've not found a good solution to it.
Okay.
But
that's fair. But that I get that you're making me think really of other cases like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll say I also let players delay. So if I get to somebody, this happened like 2 weeks ago, can I wait until after that person? I go say, yes, absolutely. Remind me about it. They don't ask for that very often, so it isn't a big tripping point.
There was a time when I was playing where I was playing more consistently with miniatures on the table, which is not to say that I was drawing out a map of every space that the players ever went in. But I was using the miniatures more representationally and this works better in a campaign where I can quickly associate the miniature with the character. And I would have players like arrange their miniatures in a little cluster on the table that is their marching order. And then I would look at that instead of the humans around the table. I would look at that group of miniatures and I would do the order of those miniatures. And that's like a nice visual. It's got the same visual reminder for me of what order to go in, but it allows for rearranging based on circumstance. Enjoyed that.
Now, you know, great. That's a great strategy. I think you may know that a couple times, particularly in like convention sessions, I've offered an initiative bonus for the players sitting in their standard marching order. So I've said, if you rearrange yourself at the table to match your standard marching order, you'll get a +1 initiative. And generally, players take me up on that. So instead of modifying the order for the miniatures, Paul, I rearranged the players to match the miniatures.
That's funny.
You know, it might not work in every circumstance, but it's a little novel thing that occurred to me at some point. You might try that in your game sometime.
All right. I'll keep that one in mind. Dan, we are about out of time here. Any final thoughts on combat sequence of OD&D versus basic versus what we use, which is neither.
I appreciate, right, Tom, again, I'm going to praise Tom Moldvay for taking smart editorial steps to you know, on the transition from the war game to an actual one-on-one role-playing game. And so at least, like with the combat sequence, at least he got away from both sides being phased, of both, you know, both opponents do all their movement and then all their missiles and their all magic. So at least he had each, you know, one side do a thing and then the other side do all their kind of thing. At least he got in and tried to do some kind of, well, there you go. And at least he tried to manage the free attacks for retreating, 3 times out of 6, half of your movement, right? And at least he was, the to my awareness, the first person to suggest using 5-foot squares to map the miniatures, even though it contradicted another part of the rules, right? So he was definitely in the right direction, yeah. And the first for a lot of stuff. And even though we've evolved, you know, even past that at this point, I think that he showed the way. And I think that BX was a really interesting jumping off point for how a role, you know, a fun, welcoming to newbies role-playing game could look. And frankly, he was doing a lot of the grunt work to make that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to like about BX. It is still kind of my favorite print of the game. That said, there are a couple of things where I don't mind house ruling them. Encumbrance is one, and the combat sequencing is the other. Both I'm like, oh, you're so close. You're so close, Mr. Moldvay, but not quite there.
Agreed.
Yeah, I like what we've come up with organically, and it's funny that like I can't really point to any specific edition of the game and say, oh, well, we just use, you know, 3rd edition or 5th edition or whatever edition. We use, I don't know. Again, I think the Monopoly edition is what we're using.
I can't believe that they still have the free attacks from retreating rule. I keep expecting, and here we are with the revision to 5th edition and a half or whatever it is here in 2024. And I, every single time they release an edition, I assume they're finally going to get rid of that crazy retreat rule, which I think has clearly been an error since 1974. But here we are, 50 years plus, still counting. Wandering DMs don't do it that way. Neither should you.
Viewers, if you have an opinion on a better way to do combat ordering, combat sequencing, you have a favorite one from the various editions of D&D, you agree with Dan and I that it should be house-ruled into something more custom, let us know. Give us your thoughts in the comment section of the YouTube video here. We'd love to hear from you, and possibly that will inspire a future show.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering and DMs on all the sites. So please look for us there and smite that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us through various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us on one of those sites right now and it gives you the opportunity to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons here who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll see all our different tiers. And just like Paul said, at the top of the hour, every single tier gets you access to our private Discord server, where the conversation continues 24/7 about all kinds of topics around role-playing and miniatures and stuff like that, war games and all kinds of stuff. And we will be there in about 10 minutes to continue the discussion with our live video after chat. And we love seeing our patrons there. If this will be your first time, we love having new people in our weekly after chat. So hopefully you'll be there. And don't forget that, of course, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.